BBC News. Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Hillary Clinton made history last night by becoming the first woman to accept a major political party nomination. 15,000 reporters were in Philadelphia to cover this historic event. 15,000 reporters were also in Cleveland last week covering the Republican convention. So what did you think? The convention got wall-to-wall coverage, so many stories. The cable shows covered it. From about 4 to 5 to 9 o'clock, PBS and NPR got together to cover it. What did you think of the coverage? Where did you see coverage of actual issues? What about the influence of money in politics and the real state of the country? Who actually left the convention to go out to, for example, cover the protests, or to go out into Cleveland and Philadelphia and find out what's actually happening on the ground? What is the state of those two cities with so many reporters in town? Today, we are joined by three journalists to talk about these issues. Leslie Clark is White House correspondent with McClatchy Newspapers, and she joins us from, you're still in Philadelphia, right, Leslie?
Yeah, I'm still in Philadelphia.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us. And I know you're going to be joining us while multitasking. You're going to watch Hillary Clinton. She's already in. Where is she right now giving a speech?
She and Tim Kaine are going to make their first joint post-convention campaign appearance about, you know, a couple miles away from me in Temple University.
Okay.
My colleague's there, but I'm also watching on TV.
Okay, so I know you have to multitask, and if anything is interesting, you can let us know. Thanks for joining us. We're also joined by Dave Leventhal, senior political reporter with the Center for Public Integrity, and Dave and his team have been doing really great journalism on all of the money, the funding of the convention, and also which corporations are funding the parties. Hi, Dave. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, good to be with you.
Great to have you. Will Bunch is a senior writer with the Philadelphia Daily News and author of its popular blog, Attitude. He's also author of several books. His most latest is The Byrne Identity, A Search for Bernie Sanders and the New American Dream. Hi, Will. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Rose. How are you?
Good. So the convention was in your hometown. So as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight reporting that stood out this week. So Dave Leventhal, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
When I find myself steeped in politics, where Democrats and Republicans and speeches and conventions are pretty much wall-to-wall 24 hours, I try to find something that is going to be as anti-political as possible. And I found a fascinating article in the Washington Post, kind of a medical mystery. It's called In Looking for Zebras, Doctors Are Stumped. And zebras are kind of a slang term for exotic medical diagnoses. And I won't give away exactly what happened in this article, which was written by author Sandra Boodman, but it basically involved a 2.5-year-old, something very close to my heart, and that I have a 2.5-year-old son who came in with bleeding gums and couldn't walk, and they thought he had a broken leg, but he didn't, and all of these very, very odd symptoms that they just simply couldn't figure out. And ultimately, what the cause of these maladies were something that wasn't associated with 2016 quite at all. It would have been associated much more with folks perhaps back in the 18th century. So I'll leave it at that.
Huh, interesting. All right. Well, thank you for that. We'll find that story and put a link at Your Call Radio right after the show. That's Dave Leventhal with the Center for Public Integrity. And Will Bunch, what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, gosh, I just went the opposite direction from Dave. I guess I've been too immersed. My head's been in these conventions for months going into this, and I've kind of been in the bubble. So, I thought the New York Times did a fantastic job covering kind of the hypocrisy of a Democratic Party talking about working people, but then just having these incredibly swank fundraisers funded by all the major corporations in Center City, a couple miles away from the convention zone. I think they really nailed it with their piece this week that was headlined after laying low, deep-pocketed Clinton donors return to the fore. They went to the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, which is one of the finer hotels here in Philadelphia, and just kept their ears open and heard people talking about, what ambassadorships might be up in the Hillary Clinton administration, and just the amounts of money being tossed around. And to me, I watched a lot of the TV coverage and was there some of the time in the Wells Fargo Center, like many of your listeners. And you get one story from the podium, but when you get away from the podium, you can get a completely different view of how the status quo just continues, no matter how much talk about change you hear up on the stage.
Mm. Yeah, I'd like to ask you all about that later in the show, because when we did convention shows, we talked a little bit about this. On one hand, you have so many incredible activists take to the stage, mothers who lost their black sons and daughters to either police violence or other gun violence. You had disability rights activists. You had other family members who lost their loved ones to gun violence. You had a domestic worker on stage. I mean, so many amazing people took to the stage and had a very progressive message to send, while at the same time, as you said, Will, corporations funding these parties. Politico had a piece about how all of these Wall Street bankers were flocking to Philadelphia. So I'd like to ask you all about that later in the show. So kudos to the New York Times for that story. And who wrote it?
I'd have to get my glasses.
That's okay.
On.
We'll find it. That's fine. Yeah. Thank you. That's Will Bunch. He's a writer with the Philadelphia Daily News. And Leslie, what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Oh, I saw so much stuff that we had out there that was just done really terrifically. But this morning I was kind of struck. I missed the gentleman who spoke about his son who was killed in Iraq yesterday, but saw a lot of the coverage of it this morning, and then saw a story that the Washington Post actually did several years ago, a background on the father that I was really struck by. It was a really nice piece. And it just got me wondering if the Clinton campaign or the Obama campaign or something had seen this piece and remembered it and thought he'd be a good person to have speak for them.
And you're talking about the father of the Muslim army soldier.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Right, the father of a Muslim army soldier who was killed in Iraq took to the stage. He was killed in a car bomb in Iraq in 2004.
Yeah, and the Post had actually done a story about the father back, I think the story ran in 2005, and it's just a really heartbreaking profile. A little bit of the man behind the news.
Hmm. Yeah, Will, that one really got me. I mean, here you have a Muslim family taking to the stage, talking about their Muslim son who was sent to a war in a Muslim country.
Yeah, I thought that the convention organizers for the Democrats just did a remarkable job of finding identifying themes and finding people to counter some of the ugly message that came out of Cleveland the week before. And I think this is absolutely right that to hear this message about patriotism coming from the father of a Muslim soldier. And there was a lot of talk this morning, and I think what the Democrats did best at their convention is kind of redefine patriotism for the 21st century and what it means to be American and what it means to love this country, that it doesn't always just have a white face, and it just doesn't, and that there's all types of there's all types of ways of portraying that. I mean, at its best, it was fantastic. I mean, at times I felt that they were trying to present such a diverse group that they were stepping on their own message sometimes. I mean, it struck me that, one of the highlights they tried to portray was having Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York, endorse Hillary Clinton, who, probably would have, his cops probably would have stopped and frisked the sons of the mothers of the movement who spoke the night before, So there is a danger sometimes of muddling your message with so much of this, but they definitely showed a much more diverse America than you saw in Cleveland. There's no doubt about that.
Well, and I just got the names of this father, and I also want to say the mother was on stage. The father's getting most of the attention, Kazir Khan, because he spoke, and his wife Ghazala stood next to him. Maybe she couldn't speak. I mean, she looked incredibly sad on stage, but it was both the father and the mother. So, all right, thank you for that, Leslie. That's Leslie Clark. She's White House correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, and they were both from Pakistan. And if you'd like to join us to talk about coverage of these conventions, 15,000 reporters in Philadelphia, 15,000 reporters in Cleveland, what did you think of the coverage? It was wall to wall. If you turned on KALW, you heard special coverage. PBS and NPR teamed up, and then we also carried coverage from The Takeaway in the evening. So what did you make of that? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can tweet us at Your Call Radio. And I think we may have lost someone there. Leslie, are you still with us? Oh, actually, I was going to go to Leslie to talk about Hillary Clinton becoming the first woman to accept a major political party nomination. Because before we get in and talk about the coverage and the money, I just want to acknowledge this. I know we've got a lot of older women who listen to our show, who have worked like hell over their lives for on issues like equality, equal pay, abortion. And it's really easy to be cynical, especially as journalists. But Will Bunch, what was the mood like, especially among the older women in the room who were dressed up like suffragettes?
Right. Well, to me, that was I thought that was a brilliant touch, you know, as shallow as we can be sometimes, both as journalists and even non-journalists, and, you know, speculating on, oh my gosh, what is Hillary going to wear for this big night? And, you know, I mean, sometimes that's overdone. But in this case, it really was a story, because I think that was a brilliant tribute that kind of, you know, drove home the historical significance of what was happening there without hammering people over the head with it, you know, so much that I thought that was a really nice touch. And, you know, I mean, it's fascinating, a kind of a divide we've seen. And as you mentioned, the women who were kind of most moved by this, you know, tend to be, you know, women perhaps, I don't know, over 50, you know, certainly, or even older. And, understandably, because they did grow up in a time where people have dredged up some great stories this week from as late as the 1970s of saying, well, maybe we'll have a woman president by 2076, or just the kind of in our lifetimes, you know, I'm 57, you know, in my lifetime, just the kind of sexist tone to this question of whether there would be a woman president. And so I mean, it's a very cathartic moment. What I was going to say, though, is interesting, though, is You didn't see quite the same vibe among women, say under 30 or under 35 in this election. You know, on the Democratic side, a majority of women under 30 supported Bernie Sanders, a 74-year-old white man. I think part of that is because the mood has changed so much that these women felt that there will be a female president in my lifetime. I just don't want Hillary Clinton to be that one. I'd rather wait another decade or two for one that who represents my political viewpoints more. So that was a fascinating dichotomy in this election. But there's no doubt that, you know, there was I believe it was 93 or 94 year old female delegate at the convention who, as everybody pointed out, was born before women had universal suffrage in this country. So we shouldn't forget the significance of this.
No, and I completely agree. I mean, some of these women were around before abortion was legal, and the young women better fight to make sure that doesn't happen again, because on the Republican side, that's the route they want to take. Dave, what about you? What stood out for you just in terms of this historic moment and how it's being covered?
I thought back to a couple of months ago when I was back in my hometown of Buffalo, New York, to speak to some middle school students at my middle school that I went to when I was a kid, and I was kind of comparing notes with a few of them at one point, and we were having a nice conversation, and they were asking me about what it was like when I was in middle school, and that was during the late 80s, early 90s, and we got talking about the presidency and Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, and I asked them, I said, well, what's the earliest you remember the president? And they said, well, you know, kind of when Barack Obama was younger. And it just kind of struck me, the light bulb went off at that point, that they've never been alive where they remember a president who was a white male. And kind of take that at its face, it's a remarkable period of time that we're in, where kids who are 12, 13, 14 years old, they only know the president as either a black man, or quite possibly somebody who is going to be a woman, mm-hmm. and think about the history of the United States going back, and look at this through the prism of history, and that really just shows how we've evolved as a country, where it's not only possible for somebody who's not a white male to become president, but it's the norm for the youngest members of our country, of our society. And so, you know, as you watch the convention take place on the Democratic side this week, it was impossible to ignore the historical significance of what was going on, regardless of whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, conservative or a liberal. This is a remarkable time for a number of reasons, but that certainly is among the reasons why this particular election cycle is indeed remarkable.
Mm. Leslie Clark, what about you? What would you tell us about the mood in the room and the coverage?
Yeah, 15,000 reporters was pretty amazing. Actually, in Cleveland, cab driver said to me, "Are there really 15,000 reporters here? Like, what are you all going to do?" I tried to explain to him. It was pretty interesting, the mood in the room. I think it was. Sorry, I've got Kane in one ear. Let me take him out for a second.
Okay.
The mood in the room with the first woman president, I think, because Clinton's brand has been so tarnished, I think that's part of the reason a lot of women have trouble embracing her and being excited about it. But I still think it was quite a moment for a lot of women. I think myself and a couple other people in the press, you know, took us 3 seconds to sort of go, whoa, a woman just came out and accepted the nomination. That's something we've never seen. And, you know, so that was it was a pretty neat moment.
Mm-hmm. And I have to say, I mean, the punditry last night, I mean, as long as Donald Trump doesn't call women pigs, he's fine. But no matter what she does, regardless of what you think about her policies, she's just, it's not good enough. I mean, just the expectations. I mean, it was just so over the top if you watched the broadcast coverage. Everybody had to have an opinion about what she needed to do. And then after the speech, because she doesn't give the best speeches, she failed.
Yeah, I noticed that somebody got called out on Twitter by suggesting that she needed to do a strong speech and she needed to smile, which is something that women kind of get a little ticked off about, always being told that they need to do that. She also had the unfortunate, no matter what sex she was, of following in the footsteps of Barack Obama and Bill Clinton and Joe Biden, who, you know, just do deliver fantastic speeches. So I think a lot of it was seen in that venue.
That is,
Will. Yeah, I'm sorry. I just want to add one thing to that real quickly, which is I think journalists in particular find themselves in a difficult spot with this situation for two kind of different reasons. I mean, you know, as Americans, it's exciting this idea that a woman can be president. You know, but you know, you have to play that off, the natural skepticism or cynicism, as we might call it, that reporters are supposed to have. So often, when you try and balance that, you can go too far the other way. And then I think that's doubled in this case, in which you know, the Republican Party has nominated a candidate. You know, demagogue is the nicest word you can probably say about him. You know, many consider him to be a new kind of fascist. You know, you had speakers like Mike Bloomberg at this convention questioning Donald Trump's sanity. So, you know, so here you have the first woman president. She's running against a guy that I think thinking people find to be dangerous to this country, and so you don't. But the journalist instinct is to go the opposite. You know, I've got to fight these two instincts to say, wow, you know, it's exciting as a woman, and boy, she made a lot of sense compared to Trump. So I think there's a tendency to look to nitpick, you know, to look for, you know, yeah, she did good, but it wasn't soaring enough, or, you know, she, you know, whatever. So I think, I mean, I don't know. I mean, that might be inside baseball for some people, but I think I'm trying to give people a mindset into how a lot of journalists think, for better or worse. Mm. You know?
And we just got an email from a listener, Kathleen, who sent a story that was written over at PBS, and it's called The Hidden Sexism That Could Sway the Election. Thank you for that, Kathleen. We'll read it and maybe do a show. I think it's also important, because now we're sort of moving into the general election, it's important to remember that Donald Trump got $2 billion worth of uncritical media, free media coverage last year, and most media don't talk about it because they're guilty of doing it. And, I mean, you had on MSNBC, Morning Joe, for the past, you know, 6 to 10 months, had a phone call with Trump almost every morning, and it was so softball. And I watched a clip from Morning Joe this morning, and now he's railing on Trump, basically saying that the guy is off the rails and Republicans need to defeat him. I mean, this is the same guy who just gave him all this free coverage. So, Will, I just think it's important to remember that. Trump got so much free, uncritical coverage.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bizarre phenomenon, you know, and I'm thinking maybe partially a print journalist to some degree. I mean TV journalists, maybe not the working journalists, but their bosses are driven by ratings, and we've had people like CBS's Les Moonves say, right, hey, Donald Trump, he might be bad for America, but he's been great for our ratings, and that, I mean, that's one of just the most appalling comments that have been made during this campaign. So yes, you're right. I mean. You know, the media has this kind of love-hate relationship where, you know, the political analysts, are skeptical of Trump as they should be, and the people, you know, the accountants are seeing higher ratings and they love it. You know,
I think it's important to make a distinction between broadcast and print. Leslie, how does McClatchy plan to cover Trump from here on out?
And I was going to say, but it's the same thing with print and online. I mean, we like to think of ourselves as an online media as much company as print, and it's the same thing. We want to get clicks, you want to have readership, that's the only way to survive. And Donald Trump, you never know what he's going to say, and so that is something that, you know, attracts people and draws people, because it's not man bites dog every event that he has. And, you know, we don't know how to get away from that, and it's an unfortunate reality, but you know, it takes money to produce news.
Right. So how does McClatchy plan to cover Trump in the coming 4 months? Because we're asking ourselves this question all the time.
Yeah, I mean, we'll have two reporters on him, like we have two reporters on Secretary Clinton, and we'll just try to do as much fact-checking as we can in every story that we write, and try to hold him to what he says. We've tried to do some, you know, researching of his background. I did a story with my colleague a couple of weeks ago that sort of looked at the scope of his businesses and what that would mean for if he became president, because he obviously shows a lot of interest in his business, even as he, you know, says that he turned it over to his children, that he'll still know what's happening. And so what about those agencies that his would be regulated, that his, you know, his businesses would be regulated by, the Environmental Protection Agency, to name one. We tried to look at that and what that might say about him. And the conflicts are, like, just staggering, and it's unprecedented.
Hmm. And Dave, what are your plans at the Center for Public Integrity?
We're holding both candidates accountable and their feet to the fire when it comes to the issue that is the cornerstone of our coverage, which is political influence and campaign money and lobbying and all those various types of things. So, for example, with Donald Trump, we had a piece that ran last month, which was a very investigative, detailed look. It was called Donald Trump's Big Money Bait and Switch, and how Donald Trump had presented himself as sort of the ultimate self-funder, that he was not beholden to other billionaires. He didn't have to use anyone else's money. He didn't need donors. He was self-funded. He was self-sustainable as a candidate. And as it would come to pass in the past few months, he's done effectively a 180. Same thing on Hillary Clinton's side. We also did a story on Bernie Sanders, but with Hillary Clinton, we had showed in an investigative article how Hillary Clinton, although she talks a very, very strong game when it comes to overturning Citizens United and getting big money out of politics, she has been, not arguably, but definitively, the chief beneficiary of the freedoms that have come in the post-Citizens United world of campaign funding. So, you know, it's a very, very turbulent time right now. The laws have changed so dramatically. The rules are almost in flux as we go along. So we're looking very deeply at all candidates involved to see what they're doing, what they're saying, and whether their actions hold up against their words.
And Dave, before we go to break, you and your team have done great reporting on the ground in Philadelphia, focusing on special interest money, the corporate schmoozing. I read, and I think Center for Public Integrity was the only place I read this, that Monsanto funded funded some of the convention. Walmart funded the convention, the usual Silicon Valley companies, Lockheed Martin. What other corporations stood out for you and how they their involvement?
You could go on and on. Chevron and AT&T and Comcast and Uber was really big, too. And you just had a laundry list of blue chip companies and also those who were looking to make a splash, too. At an event where you effectively have the most concentrated power player population that you possibly can get. It makes Washington, D.C. here almost look small time. Anyone who is anyone, for all intents and purposes, is going to be at these conventions in a political context, either Republican or Democrat, Philadelphia or Cleveland. So as a result, if you are a special interest, if you are a corporation or a trade association with a lot of business before Congress, if you want to get in good with politicians who have a lot of power or are seeking a lot of power, then this is the place to be. And you know, for $100,000 or $500,000 or whatever it is you pay to get your name splashed all over the place or to get into exclusive parties where you're going to have the opportunity to talk to folks that you really, really want to connect with, that's worth it to you because down the line it's going to potentially pay off. It's a gamble that all of these corporations, special interests, unions, be it what it may make, but oftentimes it's a good one for them because if it didn't work and the rate of return wasn't pretty darn good, they wouldn't do it.
And Dave, when these companies host these parties after the convention's over or when it's happening, do politicians go to these parties to meet executives from these corporations? I mean, can you explain how the deal making is done and how these corporations get direct access to these politicians?
Sure. There are a number of parties that are conducted behind closed doors that are not open to the public or the press, where lawmakers and lobbyists or corporate executives, or be it who it is, will get together and have the opportunity over many drinks or really nice food or whatever at a bar or a restaurant or a club, oftentimes with great entertainment, will have the opportunity to connect with each other. Now, it's unlikely in most of these things that they're sitting in some sort of smoke-filled back room just plotting out the future of America with each other, but these are social engagements that sort of serve as a political lubricant for the machinery of government going forward, and definitely you can endear yourself in a way to a politician as a lobbyist or a corporate executive if you go to one of these things, but you have to buy your way in, and that's what we found time and time again with many of these affairs that were oftentimes billed as, you know, a tribute to the House whip or, you know, a tribute to the Democrats from Nebraska. I'm making these up, but that's effectively what you had time and time again, over and over again, both in Cleveland for the Republicans and in Philadelphia for the Democrats. And this is not exclusive to one party or the other. It was happening in both places to a very similar degree in 2016.
And after the break, Will Bunch, who lives in Philadelphia, will tell us what would happen if you just drive a couple miles away from the Ritz-Carlton. You will see an area where income inequality has soared for 35 years under Republican governments and Democratic governments. That is Dave Leventhal, senior political reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. Leslie Clark is White House correspondent with McClatchy, and Will Bunch is a senior writer with the Philadelphia Daily News. It's your call. It's our media roundtable, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, you're welcome to join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. Lines are filling up real fast, though. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You may post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or you may tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @yourcallradio. Coming up in a half hour at 11 o'clock, it's Inflection Point here on 91.7 KALW. Stay tuned.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation with historian Nancy Eisenberg about her new book, White Trash, the 400-year-old untold story of class in America. Class has always been at the center of our political debate. What is its history in this country? That's on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about media coverage of the convention in Philadelphia, the convention in Cleveland last week. Hillary Clinton made history last night by becoming the first woman to accept a major political party nomination. 15,000 reporters were at both conventions. So what did you think of the coverage? Leslie Clark is White House correspondent for McClatchy. Dave Leventhal is senior political reporter with the Center for Public Integrity, where they closely follow the money. And Will Bunch is a senior writer with the Philadelphia Daily News. Will, before we get to calls, you live in Philadelphia. You know the city really well, and you wrote a really good piece about the corporate donors who were funding the convention and what happens when you drive just a few miles away from the convention. Tell us about the deep poverty that's in Philadelphia that most of us didn't really hear about this week. Will? Did we lose Will? All right, sorry about that. Let's get to calls, and then we'll get Will back. Let's hear from Herb in Oakland. Hi, Herb. Welcome to the show.
The same reaction that I called maybe, I don't know, whenever the build-up to the Gulf War was. And the question that I have has to do with, I watched most of the coverage on public TV, and half the time I felt like they were covering a wedding, mm-hmm. you know, something on the social pages. The other half of the time I felt like they were covering a sports event. And I found myself wondering, and I don't think this analogy is crazy, I found myself wondering if this were like in 1931 during Weimar and Hitler was coming to power. I was wondering whether the press would still be as constrained by this value of press neutrality mm-hmm. as they are. I believe that we are in a crisis right now, that Trump represents a proto-fascist point of view at best, and at worst he represents a proto-fascist point of view that's also very, very dangerous in terms of a kind of mindless knowledge of just how to conduct a government. This is just a very, very scary time. And there was this kind of breezy... We'll be as pointed about one side as about the other side. In the meantime, we're about to be the government is at risk for being taken over by fascism. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, like at what point do you folks, who are I respect you folks as members of the press, but at what point do you say, no, enough of this? We have to report what's going on.
Yeah. Well, I think you make a great point. I thought the broadcast coverage was incredibly disappointing for the very reasons you cite. They didn't seem like journalists. They seemed like moderators. Once in a while, they'd go down to the floor and interview a politician, and they'd laugh with the politician. They would ask very softball questions. As I said, I do think that the cable shows are kind of switching, and now they're being harder on Donald Trump. But what are your thoughts on this, Dave? I mean, you look back at how Edward R. Murrow covered McCarthy and the McCarthy hearings, and he came out and said, people, you need to stand up to this. What are your thoughts, Dave? How do you think the media should cover someone like a Donald Trump?
I think you need to go back about a year when Donald Trump was first getting into this race, and many media outlets either treated him as a fringe candidate or they treated him as entertainment. And I think he had no better example of that than the Huffington Post, which quite literally relegated Donald Trump news to its entertainment page. It wasn't to be found on the politics page, and ultimately they changed gears, but that kind of crystallizes the mentality that a lot of news outlets had, that Donald Trump was great television, and he was great copy, and he was highly entertaining, and he would say outrageous and outlandish things with this outsized personality that was fit for a show like The Apprentice, which Donald Trump had done for many years. But quickly that changed, and I think now that Donald Trump is the nominee, and we know exactly who is running for the presidency of the United States after this very protracted primary season, you have news outlets, they know the score, and there's nothing left to do but cover the general election, and these are the two candidates. So as much as Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have changed and evolved over the course of this campaign, so too has the press to a certain degree.
Will, we lost you, but
okay,
so we had a caller, Herb, who said the media really needs to stand up and call Trump for what he is. We're in a crisis right now. What are your thoughts on that?
I've written that piece several times. I couldn't agree more. The question is, how do you do that? I mean, people have tried different approaches, and it's easier said than done. You know, I mean, I'll give you a perfect example. I mean, the Huffington Post. I mean, initially they said they were going to cover Trump as in the entertainment section. You know, that this is a joke, and you know, when he started winning primaries and was clear he wasn't a joke, they said, well, all right, we can't do that. So, you know, now they cover Trump with a disclaimer at the bottom saying that Trump is a racist, he's a xenophobe, you know, that he'd be an enormous danger to the country. You know, this disclaimer appears at the bottom of every story. And, you know, the problem is, you know, I mean, Trump's base of support is 35 to 40% of the American public that, you know, thinks the media are elitists who have a liberal bias against, you know, working people or against, you know, police officers and firefighters. And so the louder you get about how Trump is a danger to the country, he's a demagogue, et cetera, the more it's like, see how afraid these elitists are of somebody who's, you know, quote, telling it like it is, even though 90% of his statements are found to be false or, you know, half true or whatever. So, you know, when you're an Ivy League educated journalist working inside the Beltway and you're saying, hey, this guy's a danger, is going to destroy the country, if you're, you know, an unemployed steel worker in Ohio who's, you know, who's worked up about elites, is that person going to be swayed by your argument? No, not really. So there's only, you know, I mean, at some point it becomes kind of preaching to the choir, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So it's difficult.
And Leslie, what would you add?
Sorry, I've been listening to Hillary Clinton.
that's all right. We just had a caller who said the media really need to get serious about Donald Trump and what he really stands for.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard that criticism, and I mean, I think there's always more that can be done. I think a lot of those stories are out there. People are searching for it. The problem is, I think people, you know, attitudes and decisions and ideas get pretty much settled, and people will, you know, read into things what their prevailing attitude or what their prevailing thoughts already are. But I absolutely agree. We need to continue to do more on both cases, in both sides. We should be, you know, investigating who these people are and who, you know, what they would do to the country.
And Leslie, what are your thoughts about what goes on behind the scenes with these special interest groups, corporations, and other organizations that pay for these parties and then get face-to-face time with politicians? How should the media cover this, especially when you're, you know, not allowed to go to some of these parties?
Yeah, I love all the Sunlight Foundation and all the groups that try to force open coverage or force open those fundraisers and various parties, because it is just amazing that people have such access to politicians that normal people definitely wouldn't have. I think it's something that we just keep pushing to do. We definitely push it. I'm a White House correspondent. The Obama administration has allowed us into fundraisers that the president has, but you get kicked out when he does the Q&A. But, you know, coverage and sunshine is definitely helpful for it.
And Dave, The Intercept had a piece called Oil Lobby Paid Washington Post and The Atlantic to host a climate change deniers roundtable at the RNC. And so you've got these oil industry lobbyists picking up the tab for these media companies to host discussions. And what are your thoughts on this? And did any of this happen at the Democratic convention?
It happened at both the Democratic and the Republican national conventions, for better or for worse. There are a number of media corporations, including those that are based or have operations in D.C., that run what is effectively an events business, separate and apart from the journalism that's done, but oftentimes involving journalists. And full disclosure, I used to work for Politico. I've participated in some. You don't have any knowledge even going in of who the sponsors are, but yet they are there, and they're sponsoring that event almost like they would taking out an advertisement in a newspaper or putting up a banner on a website. But, you know, they're with The Atlantic or Politico or whatever it is sponsored by fill-in-the-blank with a corporation. So there's definitely plenty of opportunities for various special interests to align themselves with media operations and in these events that go on that are sponsored by media organizations. So, you know, you can debate the merits of that or the unseemliness of those relationships, but those relationships most certainly exist, and they exist both with the Democrats and the Republicans for their national conventions. And, you know, that's not too terribly different, at least at its face, from what is going on with sort of the closed-door operations or events that are taking place in the convention. But that is the big difference, is that you with the media organizations, you have open-door events, and with various other special interests that are sponsoring events and soirees and schmooze fests with politicians. Those are outside of the glare of the media camera light or the reporter with a notepad or whatnot. That all being said, myself and my two colleagues, Michael Beckel and Carrie Levine, who are in Philadelphia, we got into several of these events, even though we weren't invited, found our way in, and were able to see what goes on inside. And oftentimes it's exactly as you would expect it, that it's a very small group. You have a lot of very powerful people from politics, from special interest groups, whatnot, and they have an opportunity in a very, very, very close quarters kind of way to go and get to know each other. So it just raises the obvious question of, well, all right, if you're an average red-blooded American living in California or Florida or New York or wherever you are in the country, and you don't have any money to go to Cleveland or Philadelphia, or you don't have some sort of access to power, well, where does that put you? And I'll tell you where it puts you. It puts you in Cleveland or Florida or New York or wherever you're sitting. You don't have access to those types of events. So there's definitely two worlds that exist, and there's many different tiers of how politics is done, and this particular tier that we're talking about is pretty much at the top of the heap. It's the most powerful with the most money all together in a room together having a good time.
Well, there's a problem when the media are also involved in this, and I'm guessing that your publications don't sell access. But The Intercept reported that The Atlantic, Politico, The Economist, CQ Roll Call, The Hill, they were basically saying for $200,000, we will host a discussion for up to three named executives or organization representatives of your choice. And this happened. I mean, The Intercept reports that The Atlantic had two climate change deniers on a panel and said, well, we couldn't find anyone to debate them, so we had to go and move forward and have this panel with two climate change deniers, and they were paid thousands and thousands of dollars to do it.
Yeah, I mean,
Will.
This is appalling that this happens, and you know, it's an unfortunate byproduct of the economic crisis facing journalism. You know, when traditional advertising, you know, and look, I mean, obviously, and news organizations have had issues about possibly kowtowing to advertisers, you know, going back decades, if not centuries, right? But I mean, this is just a new and more alarming twist, where you know, companies that are barely breaking even or losing money because of the terrible economic climate for journalism these days, are willing to do this to get $200,000 or whatever. You know, you mentioned before, and I just wanted to mention quickly, I mean, just some of the contradictions that arise from some of this stuff. You know, I mean, we heard from the podium a number of times in Philadelphia this week how the Democrats are the party of working people. But, you know, these ties can cause them to basically sell out working people. You know, Dave mentioned earlier, and I want to mention too, I mean, Uber definitely was one of the most visible companies at this convention. You know, a company that's owned by kind of a notorious hard-edged entrepreneur from your neck of the woods, Travis Kalanick, you know, a billionaire that you know, it's a very divisive company, but the people who are hurt by Uber's success are cab drivers who, you know, in some cases are unionized. A lot of them are immigrants or other kinds of drivers trying to work their way up the ladder, and their world's just been turned upside down by Uber, which, you know, went out and hired one of President Obama's closest political advisors, formerly David Plouffe, to be its lobbyist. And, you know, I was just struck through the entire DNC by how much what you might call class-related issues, you know, or issues related to labor and, you know, income inequality were just subordinated to other things. I mean, you know, most big corporations are pro-LGBT rights. You know, most big corporations certainly at least pay lip service to this disabled. And it was wonderful that the Democrats showcased some of these issues. But people from, like, organized labor, you know, to the extent that they did speak, you know, Rich Trumka from the AFL-CIO was given bumped about as far out of prime time as he possibly could. And you didn't really hear these voices. And yet these are the people who are the most upset in this country right now. And not just, I mean, it's been because of Trump, there's been a lot of focus on the white working class, but the entire working class, white, black, Latino, Native American, whatever, you know, these are the people scraping to get by. And I do feel that there can be a correlation between these, you know, cocktail parties and smoothing and access and what you actually gets emphasized, you know, during the convention.
Yeah, and you report, Will, that there's a very high rate of poverty in Philadelphia, almost 26%. 12% live in deep poverty.
Absolutely, and there wasn't much overt stuff on poverty at the DNC, and there certainly wasn't a mention of much mention, if at all, of homelessness, even though you know, Philadelphia, like San Francisco, like many other cities, have enormous homelessness problems right now. You know, people desperately in need of help, and you know, when you come to Philadelphia or when you come to Cleveland, I mean, when I went to Cleveland, the first place I went was not to get my press credentials at the convention hall, but the first place I went was to the playground where 12-year-old Tamir Rice was shot a year and a half ago. And, you know, I wanted to talk to people in neighborhoods like that about what the convention means to them. And, you know, I think there's a lot of deep-seated issues that Americans feel that, you know, for 8 days with hours and hours of television, that their issues were not spoken to some degree.
Right. And Leslie, just quickly, you're a White House correspondent for McClatchy. What about reporters in D.C.? Are the issue? Do they talk about issues of poverty and homelessness? And, you know, a lot of people are struggling right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's still a huge issue. Being here in Philadelphia, you see it a lot in Washington, D.C., you see it as well in the cities. I mean, and in rural communities, too. I used to be a reporter in Florida for years, and it's just such a lingering, heartbreaking problem that definitely deserves attention.
Well, we've got just a couple minutes. Wish we had a little more time here, but let's go to Mark in San Francisco. Thanks for holding, Mark.
Yeah, actually wanted to speak on a similar topic to your previous caller about the PBS NPR coverage. I listened on the radio, and the coverage is just appalling. Mm. It was, very, very shallow, and as Herb said, it was exactly as if they were covering a sporting event or maybe a movie opening. And I want to say very specifically where I finally started really yelling at the radio was when Cory Booker was giving a fantastic speech, and in the middle of it, they cut away and started having their little trivial chat. It was really shameful.
Well, you should write an email, because people read their email, and I think it's really important to express your opinions about these things. Thanks for calling. Let's go to Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry.
Yes, good morning. I want to say, first of all, I really don't agree about that Cory Booker speech, but I wanted to ask. I heard David K. Johnson say on your program there wouldn't be any debates, so I was wondering, do reporters know anything about any plans for debates? And who decides who hosts the debates? And which questions are asked? And which questions do your reporters believe should be covered and should be asked?
Yeah, great question. Leslie, David K. Johnston, an investigative reporter who just wrote a book about Donald Trump, was on last week and says he does not think there will be any debates because neither side has anything to gain from them. What are your thoughts on that? I haven't heard anything about scheduled debates. Have you?
No, I haven't heard anything yet, but I mean, their general, I think that would be just an amazing...
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say all of 2016 has been surprising, but that would be unprecedented. I mean, there are three scheduled events as far as I know, and I can't imagine that they won't hold them.
Will, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I was just going to make that last point that she made, which is, I mean, there definitely are. I mean, I believe the League of Women Voters is still the sponsor as they historically have been, but these events are scheduled way in advance. And the locations, which I can't remember what they are, but they've announced three scheduled times for three locations. I know one of them.
Is in September.
Go ahead.
In September.
Yeah, the first one is in September at Hofstra University up in New York.
Well, former Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell, in a piece I'm just looking at right now, says he doesn't think that there will be any debates.
I don't know. My first thought on that is that Donald Trump. It's not being in the limelight, and I think he might agree to do it just because he just was, you know, he missed out on three nights of enormous attention. So,
but we do have precedent for him skipping the Fox News debate during the primary. So, but I mean, that would be unprecedented. I mean, that's just been tradition. I think it's the Commission on Presidential Debates. You know, like you said, plans in years in advance. They already have the site. Places that they're going to hold them at, usually a university, which pairs it with a lot of, you know, programs for students.
Dave, are you hearing anything about debates?
Yeah, same thing that my colleagues have said. I would just add that there's no mandate that the candidates have to debate, but yes, it would be pretty unprecedented, and it would be something that could massively backfire on a candidate who refused to debate, something that could be looked upon very poorly. But I just want to go back to a point that two callers ago, I think, made about the coverage of everything that's going on and all of the proceedings of the conventions. C-SPAN was effectively who I watched the most. And C-SPAN, if you have not watched their coverage, you might think that they're the most boring network in the world. Well, that's kind of the point. They give you this absolutely unvarnished look at everything that's going on. They've got a camera trained on the action and action only. There is a minimum of commentary. So if Fox News or MSNBC or CNN or whatever the network is turns you off, you do have an alternative if you have cable, and it's something that you should definitely check out. It was great for the conventions. You heard every single speaker. You never cut away.
Dave Leventhal is senior political reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. Leslie Clark is a White House correspondent with McClatchy. And Will Bunch is senior writer with the Philadelphia Daily News. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you. Thank you. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with historian and professor Nancy Eisenberg about her new book, White Trash, the 400-year-old untold history of class in America. She writes that the 1% is the most recently adopted shorthand to bring attention to the ills generated by power. But this is nothing new. Class has always been at the center of our political debate. So what is the history of class in the United States? It's Your Call with Renee Kemp and you.